As an Australian who's currently living overseas, I'm delighted to be able to come home, as it were, for a few days, and I'd like to acknowledge the Noongar peoples for the privilege that I have of being able to visit this beautiful land, even if it is only for a short time. I'd also like to thank and acknowledge Aisham for the very kind invitation to come back. I grew up really as a HIV researcher during the 8 years that I spent working in Sydney under close collaboration with Aisham, and it's great to see the organization growing not only in numbers but in influence. So I've been asked today to talk a bit about antiretroviral therapy and facts and myths, and you've been hearing, I guess, a bit during this session about the impact of facts and myths in all aspects of life, not only of people living with HIV, but it also impacts significantly on research. It's just my disclosures. And we are living in quite strange times, where really it's the message that's coming through at a range of levels in society really does seem to be separating from the reality of what actually ends up happening when people embark on ventures that are maybe led by myths rather than by real true facts. And what we're tending to see is that myths propagate myths, and it's very difficult to disentangle myths, not only within general society, but also within clinical practice. How we dispel myths, in my view, is really through research, because research gives us the data that we need to very firmly put in place what we're actually observing within the clinic. And I think this reaches right across all aspects of HIV care. When I'm teaching young people within our Welcome program about how to embark on research, the key really is to try and figure out where you are in the research pathway. And the research pathway really starts off with being able to identify that a problem exists. Once you identify and describe that problem, usually through cohort studies or clinical observation studies, it can give you some insights potentially into pathogenic mechanisms, and that's where the beauty of translational research comes in. Being able to go from the bedside to the bench, work on a mechanism, validate that mechanism, and then perhaps be able to modify that mechanism to improve clinical outcomes. And that translation back to the bedside is really where we see clinical trial or interventional research coming into its own. And it's only really when you get to that stage of finishing this pathway that you're really in a position with any sort of authority to be able to advocate for significant changes in practice. Unfortunately, what we see in a lot of clinical practice is, as researchers, we're all a bit guilty of maybe overplaying our research, and therefore we start off at the top of this pathway, where we're really looking at clinical and observational studies, but we think that the quality of the data that we're generating is good enough to change practice, and that's not always the case. I'll give you a few examples of that. We've got four clinical conundrums that are facing us currently at the moment. And let's look at the quality of the data that's supporting each of these four statements and see whether or not they constitute myth or reality. So the first one is, treatment with integrase strand transfer inhibitors leads to obesity. Is loss of tenofovir-associated lipid-lowering effect clinically relevant? Tenofovir disoproxil fumarate causes long-term bone loss, and abacavir contributes to increased risk of myocardial infarction. So let's look at the first one. Treatment with integrase inhibitors leads to obesity. Is this a myth or reality? Well, this is really a subject that is very common and very topical at the moment, but really if you look back, the very first paper that I ever published with David Cooper back in the early 2000s was where we actually mapped what happened to people's weight when they started antiretroviral therapy, and guess what? People gain weight. So gaining weight with initiation of antiretroviral therapy has been known for a long time and is generally considered to be quite normal. What's happened in the intervening period is that we have this intersection with that sort of process with the epidemic around the world of the generation of obesity, which is a real entity and is having significant impacts right across the board, and therefore is likely having an impact also on HIV. If we're looking at HIV and obesity, the key is to differentiate weight gain from obesity. And that's one of the issues in terms of clinical trial reporting that leads maybe to concerns in some aspects that may not translate into a clinically meaningful outcome, which the clinically meaningful outcome really needs to be obesity. And when you look at obesity defined as a BMI over 30 kilograms per meter squared, there's obviously a lot of diversity across the world in the types of populations that you're looking at. So for example, if you're looking at a US-based population, you'll see prevalences of obesity in people living with HIV that are in the high teens. versus when you look at some European or Asian countries, the prevalence of obesity is much, much lower. So trying to put a lot of the data that we see needs to be put in the context of the population that's being studied and what stage of disease they're being studied at. The other thing about the weight gain with HIV is that it really depends at what stage you're at, not only from a disease perspective, but also from a BMI perspective will determine how much weight you gain after initiation of treatment. This is a nice study from the Côte d'Ivoire. This is a study that predates Integrase that looks at weight gain, and you can see in the dotted line that it's those individuals who start off thin that actually gain most weight. And if you already are obese in the solid line, you can see that there's very little increases in weight that are observed with initiation of treatment. Now, the signals from Integrase started coming through quite recently. This is data from the NA Accord that looked over a space of about 5 years of different people starting different antiretroviral regimes. Large observational cohort quite early on in the research pathway, large numbers, and what they were able to define was that there was a difference in terms of weight gain. And this isn't obesity, this is weight gain between those starting Integrases versus other regimes. The weight gain is about 1 kilo differential. Now, obviously, there are people on the extremes of the confidence intervals here who will gain significantly more, but a 1 kilogram weight gain is a differential you could argue may not be that clinically relevant. However, we started seeing more studies coming through, a nice study from Brazil, that actually, instead of looking at weight gain, looked at incident obesity, a much more clinically relevant endpoint. And what they found in this study was initiating treatment with an integrase inhibitor-based regime did result in about a 6-fold increased incidence of obesity, suggesting that there is a specific impact from this drug class. Further studies in switch tended to show that not only was it integrase, but when you look within the integrase inhibitor class, you're looking at effects that are more driven by L-vitegravir and dolutegravir rather than raltegravir, suggesting that this is not a cross-class effect. And most recently, what we have is data from the ADVANCED study. Now, this is a very good example of how it's really research from resource-limited settings that's driving this field. This is an open-label, randomized controlled trial in South Africa. Over 1,000 people were randomized to 3 different regimes, 2 of which contained dolutegravir. But the dolutegravir was given either with TDF or with TAF. And you can see when you look at the weight gain, over 48 weeks, you get a significantly higher weight gain in those started on dolutegravir TAF-containing regimes. Now, when you look at prevalence of newly obese, which I think is a much more clinically relevant endpoint, you can see that there really is very little difference in the prevalence of new obesity within this African cohort, whether you're started with an efavirenz-containing regime or a dolutegravir-containing regime along with TDF. Where you really start to see the gap is when dolutegravir is used with TAF. This is quite consistent with the NAMSAL study. It's another study from Cameroon, supported by the ANRS in France, which also looked at dolutegravir and efavirenz-containing regimes, but this time the third arm was 3TC and TDF. And you can see that the prevalence of new cases of obesity is remarkably similar with the ADVANCED study at 12% for the dolutegravir TDF. So these data really start to raise questions as to how much of the impact that we're seeing from the integrase effect or indeed the dolutegravir effect is actually driven by dolutegravir or how much is driven by an interaction between dolutegravir and TAF. This really does require further study. The other interesting thing about the NAMSAL study is that it has about 60 pages of supplementary material. And within that supplementary material, they break down lipids, glucose changes, between those on dolutegravir and those on efavirenz who either gained significant weight or didn't gain significant weight. And when you look at the metabolic profiles, you aren't really seeing a very negative metabolic profile associated with weight gain with dolutegravir, TDF and 3TC. And that again raises questions about the clinical relevance of this weight gain that we're seeing in the absence of TAF and whether we're actually seeing something that is more consistent with the return to health phenomenon. So I guess where we're at with obesity and integrase inhibitors is that there is a signal. I think the signal is important. It's clinically relevant in terms of the rates of obesity. But we still have some fundamental questions, namely, is this an obese picture that you could describe as an unhealthy obese picture, or is it a return to the norm? And what is the role of TAF in this? Are we actually seeing a TAF-driven effect, or are we seeing some interaction with dolutegravir and TAF? And this is really where we're at the stage now where we need a lot more data specifically on mechanisms to be able to drive the field forward. So moving on, is loss of TDF-associated lipid-lowering effect clinically relevant? Well, cardiovascular disease is one of the biggest killers of people living with HIV, specifically over the age of 40. Lipids are an important factor in that. When we looked at the clinical trials when TAF was first introduced, these were the sorts of data that are presented at clinical trial meetings for lipids, and you can see very little in terms of lipid changes in a clinical trial format when you present data as population means and medians. However, what we noticed in clinic was clinically people coming in who had switched from a TDF or switched from a regime to a TAF regime, and we were starting to see lipid values that we hadn't seen in years, sometimes cholesterol levels up around 8-9 millimoles per liter and high triglyceride levels. So because of that observation, we went back into our local cohort and started looking at those that switched to TAF to see to what extent we saw changes in lipids. And out of 775 that are enrolled in our local infectious diseases cohort, we had 194 who'd switched to TAF who had pre- and post-lipid data available. Now, when we looked at it at a population level, we got data that were very similar to the clinical trial that I showed you. But another way of looking at lipid levels is actually to look at lipid levels. They're characterized according to clinically relevant outcomes, and these are defined by the NSAID guidelines from the US. You've got five broad categories based on cholesterol values, and you can classify those as being normal and borderline, which we would call not dyslipidemic, right through to dyslipidemia, severe and very severe dyslipidemia. Now, when you relook at that population, according to these NSAID classifications, you start to get a very different picture. Just in the two middle bars here, you can see that the LDL cholesterol levels significantly deteriorate in those that are switching to a TAF-containing regime. And you can see at the top of the bar that we're starting to see the introduction of individuals with severe and very severe dyslipidemia who are switching on to TAF regimes. Of course, these sorts of studies are relatively small. We had the opportunity to work with the OPERA database in the US recently, which is a much larger database. You're looking at 93,000 individuals. We were able to define a population within that who were on TDF for 4 weeks, who switched from TDF to TAF, again, who had lipid levels pre- and post-switch, and we were able to hone this into over 2,000 individuals, almost 3,000 individuals. And you can see we had a good representation from non-male, non-Caucasian individuals, and we also had a broad representation of third agents within this study. And we saw exactly the same type of profile. When you start to look at clinically relevant cutoffs for lipids and those that are switching to TAF, this is the 6,451 individuals who switched to TAF. You can see a much higher increase of dyslipidemia as expressed by mostly LDL cholesterol dyslipidemia, but less so by triglycerides in this case, and people that are switching to TAF regimes. When we looked at only those who switched from TDF to TAF and kept their third agent exactly the same, so if they were on a boosted PI, they stayed on a boosted PI, non-nuke stayed on a non-nuke, we saw exactly the same picture. So this isn't really being driven by differences in the use of the third agent. So what we have with TDF is really a drug that is, in Europe anyway, has gone generic. There's been a push away from its use, but maybe a bit prematurely, and what we're starting to see are the consequences of that. What we've got to figure out, I guess, are the mechanisms. We've known that TDF is a lipid-lowering impact for a long time, but we really still clearly don't have a mechanism underlying that. We don't know what the clinical implications of this reversal of lipid protection from TDF are going to have over the long term in terms of rates of cardiovascular disease. Thirdly, another TDF story, tenofovir causes long-term bone loss. This is a generally held consensus that we've had heard it at many conferences for the last number of years, but does it really hold up to scientific scrutiny? Well, it's a huge amount of studies that have shown that people living with HIV have lower bone mineral density than HIV negative populations. I think that that's pretty much a given. This is a study that we have in going in Dublin called the HIV Upbeat Study. It's a longitudinal study of people living with HIV and a group of HIV negative participants from the same demographic background. So it's not people from the hospital, it's people from the local community who volunteered to become involved in the research. Because of that, we got a lot of diversity within this population, and we also have a lot of the risk factors that are represented in both that allows us to appropriately model differences. And what we found was that people living with HIV have lower bone mineral density, and that remains once you adjust for all of the main demographic factors. But the loss of bone that we see in people living with HIV is really focused around treatment initiation. This is probably one of the best studies to demonstrate this. If you are living with HIV and you're not on treatment, your bone density is stable. It's the initiation event with antiretroviral therapy that leads to bone loss. But that bone loss is limited to the first 48 weeks. And what happens is after 48 weeks, the bone density loss stabilizes. This is a study, an ACTG study, showing more loss of bone density with TDF versus abacavir, but pretty much a flat line after the first 48 weeks of treatment. From Upbeat, we've had the opportunity to follow people over 3 years. This is a cohort of whom 83% of those living with HIV are on TDF. And what you see over 3 years is that although people living with HIV have lower bone mineral density, there's no accelerated loss of bone density in people living with HIV versus the HIV negative population. The BMD loss tracks, mirrors each other, and it's about 0.2 to 0.6% per year, which for a population in their mid to late 40s isn't an entirely normal rate of bone loss. So we're not seeing evidence of long-term loss of BMD, and that's supported by clinical trials. The 0109 study was one of the TAF studies, looked at people who were on TDF, FTC, who were either randomized to stay on TDF or switched to ECF TAF. And when you look at the blue line here, this is a population that's 40 years of age, flatline. Bone mineral density in people who remain on TDF, FTC is stable. Another randomized controlled trial, we are looking at people who are in their mid-40s, on a boosted PI regime, who were switching to a boosted PI regime, but away from TDF. When you look at the blue line, pretty much a flat line. The loss there is 0.6% per year, which is entirely consistent with what we're seeing in Upbeat for a population in their mid-40s. In terms of the implications for fractures, again, the more recent data coming from the French Hospital Database study, this is a very well conducted case control study of people with HIV who've had a fragility fracture, and they've got nearly 400 people with fragility fractures here, matched to 254 cases. When they look at the impact of TDF on fragility fractures, they see no relationship. And really what this data would support is that we've fairly consistent data now to show that TDF really doesn't lead to consistent long-term bone loss, and the insult that we're seeing really arises specifically at the time of treatment initiation. Lastly, abacavir contributes to increased risk of myocardial infarction. Is this real or not? Well, this is a controversy that's now been going on for 10 years, pretty much ever since I left Australia. It was the first CROI I went to after I got back to Ireland where this data was presented, showing this association between abacavir and myocardial infarction. It's almost a doubling in risk of myocardial infarction in people who are on abacavir. And the key to this is that it's a reversible effect. While you're on the drug, you see it. While you're not on the drug, you don't see it. This has been replicated in, I don't know, about 13 or 14 different cohort studies. Hasn't been consistently seen, so it's not a consistent finding. For a couple of other cohorts or meta-analyses, which recruited relatively young people in which you wouldn't see MIs anyway. But most of the real-life cohorts we are actually observing MIs have demonstrated this effect. The key to this effect was the mechanism, and what got us interested in this was the reversibility of the mechanism. And for the last 10 years, our group has been working specifically on platelet function as a potential means of trying to identify if this is what's underlying what we're seeing with the back of ear and myocardial infarction. Now, looking at platelet function isn't easy. These are just five of the pathways shown here, collagen, ADP, thromboxane, epinephrine, thrombin, five different pathways that all independently lead to platelet activation and can lead to increased risk of myocardial infarction. And what we needed to do was to try and tease down into this, because we did some early, again, cohort studies that showed that people on a back of ear had more reactive platelets than people that weren't on a back of ear. We did some studies specifically looking at one pathway called the GP6 pathway, which is specific to platelets. We'd measured a soluble GP6 biomarker in a randomized controlled trial of about 300 or 400 participants and showed that soluble GP6 increased when you switched away from the back of ear to TDF. But that was a sort of post hoc a trial analysis. It wasn't really the quality of data that you really need to nail it. But what we did get was the opportunity within the 1717 study to study this in a lot more detail. Now, just to refresh your memory about 1717, these were a group of individuals living with HIV who were virologically suppressed on a back of ear 3TC, who were randomized to either stay on a back of ear 3TC or switch away to TAF and FTC. And what we had the ability to do within that study was to do a functional sub-study looking at platelet function in sites in Dublin and London, where we were able to look at a lot of different components of the GP6 pathway. So for example, we looked at platelet reactivity, examining each of the pathways, including collagen activation. We also looked at GP6 levels on the platelet surface by flow cytometry, and we were able to look at a variety of different soluble biomarkers in plasma, including soluble GP6. What we were able to demonstrate was when you looked at platelet reactivity, we were, in a randomized prospective controlled trial, able to see differences in platelet reactivity favoring removal of a back of ear, but mainly focusing on platelet reactivity that was driven through the collagen pathway. When we looked at platelet surface GP6, we found the platelet surface GP6, but markers such as P-selectin and CD42 beta were unchanged, but the main change that seemed to happen with a switch away from the back of ear were differences or restoration in platelet surface GP6 levels. And these were reflected in the whole study population, looking at over 500 people measured over 48 weeks, where we once again saw increases in soluble GP6 to a much greater extent than people switching off a back of ear to TAF. And what these data, in my view, really show is a very consistent systems approach, providing a valid mechanism to explain why people on a back of ear could end up with increased risk of myocardial infarctions. And this is the sort of data that I think we need to generate if we're going to more accurately change practice. So I hope those few examples have shed some light in terms of these myths versus realities that we're seeing in clinical practice. I mean, there are some commonly held beliefs in modern HIV that really don't stand up to scrutiny when you critically look at the data that's currently available. But I think research is key to clarity, and I think researchers have an obligation to report their findings consistently. It's amazing how many conferences you go to where people stand up and talk about small incremental changes very early in the research pathway as an astounding leap forward that should be changing clinical practice. And I think we probably all need to take a step back and be more realistic in terms of what our research is showing. And we can never presume that we know everything. I'm always amazed at how, as a new drug comes along, a new therapy comes along, we're seeing interactions between the people living with HIV, our background environment, together with the treatment, that will always raise more issues than we know. And just to leave you with a saying, there are some people so addicted to exaggeration that they can't tell the truth without lying. I don't think we need to think too hard before we can pick up a couple examples of people like that. But our challenge as HIV researchers and clinicians is to constantly be advocating and constantly be passing the message forward to keep reality in science and reality for clinical practice. I'd just like to acknowledge the people in the group who've helped to contribute to the data, as well as the funders, and also to all of those people both living with HIV and our HIV negative individuals, volunteers, who've all volunteered their time and their blood samples to the research that I've shown you today. Thank you very much.